Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. The 2016 presidential race is in full swing, with the Iowa caucus and New Hampshire primary just weeks away. There's a fierce battle for both the Democratic and Republican nominations for president. Will Republicans really select Donald Trump as their presidential nominee? Does Senator Bernie Sanders really have a chance to get the Democratic nomination for president? Will the left be able to build on the incredible energy of the Sanders campaign to strengthen a progressive movement nationally? Will the Republicans benefit from an unsettled international scene and people's fears about security, terrorist attacks, and the Mideast turmoil? And what will Obama do with his 1 year left as president? Here to help us understand what's happening and what it means for us is Harold Meyerson, one of the country's leading political analysts. Harold Meyerson is editor-at-large of The American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country. For the past 13 years, he has written a weekly op-ed column for The Washington Post. Previously, he was executive director of the LA Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. His articles on politics, labor, the economy, foreign policy, and American culture have also appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The Nation, The New York Times, and many other publications. Harold Meyerson, welcome back to All Together Now.
Always good to be here, Eleanor.
You're a resident, brilliant political analyst, and I'm thrilled you're here because there's so much happening right now. Let's start off with this presidential primary. Voting for the nominations begins soon in Iowa and New Hampshire, and much to many people's amazement, Donald Trump is still leading the polls among Republican voters. Do you think the Republicans will really nominate Donald Trump as their presidential candidate?
Well, let's put it this way. I think The only plausible nominees, and plausible doesn't mean, it's not a qualitative evaluation. It just means could get the nomination, would be Trump, Cruz, Rubio, and I'd say an outside chance for Chris Christie. So he's in the hunt, and we shall see. I mean, at the moment, Ted Cruz clearly has a lead in Iowa. Donald Trump clearly has a lead in New Hampshire. And after that, as the campaign moves to Super Tuesday, which is mainly in the southern states, Trump has a lead. But there's certainly a room for Cruz to do well in the south. So we shall see. I mean, part of Rubio's problem is, well, twofold. One is that there's still so many, you know, establishment Republican candidates running, which is to say the candidates who are not Trump or Cruz, that they're all cutting into each other's potential support. And two, as a number of folks, including E.J. Dionne, have noted, Rubio really hasn't gone all out in any one particular state, which means there's a limit, to when you look at where he can win, it's not really clear. That's as opposed to Chris Christie, who really has gone all out, say, in New Hampshire. So, Rubio probably has as a strategic premise that he, has supporters everywhere, and that's fine. But there was a military maxim from the Prussian king Frederick the Great that he who defends every place defends no place, which means you have to position your troops disproportionately somewhere, and Rubio hasn't done that. So anyway, but the short answer to your question is, having given the long answer, is yes, I think Trump could win the nomination. I wouldn't bet the mortgage on it, but it's certainly in the realm of possibility.
Right, and I think the longer all these other candidates stay in, the more likely he is to command the field. You know, he seems to have a ceiling of about 35% support, which means 65% want someone else, but as long as there's all those other alternatives there, they kind of cover up the pie with each other.
That's true, but then when you add Trump and Cruz together, you get an image, which I think is probably correct, of the Republican Party that is probably definitely over 50% going for the most angry and demagogic form of republicanism imaginable. So even if, I mean, if you could imagine Trump and Cruz sort of fused into one, that candidate would probably beat all of the establishment candidates if they were fused into one.
That is really scary. I mean, that sounds like a description of a horror movie. but it is the political reality we're facing right now.
Yes, that's the genre we have to think of when thinking of this year's Republican race. I don't doubt it.
Well, and many people are a combination of puzzled and disturbed that Trump and Cruz continue to lead the polls and wonder how could so many people support such demagogues. But I will say, I read your column today on the American Prospect website, which is outstanding, and you kind of go into some historical depth about how often and for how many decades, really, Republican candidates have used fears about immigration to win elections. Can you summarize for us the point you made there?
Well, what prompted the column was that this week Trump came out with his first TV ad, and it focused on immigrants streaming across the border. Of course, as they were later compelled to acknowledge, the actual footage was of people in Morocco streaming in across a border towards a little Spanish-controlled enclave in northern Africa. You know, Mexico, Morocco, they sound alike. The people don't speak English in either place. So
they're only a few thousand miles apart.
Really. And the Cruz ad, which is really fascinating, It was filmed showing these well-dressed professionals crossing the border, and with Cruz asking the question, you know, if the professional class were as threatened by immigrants as blue-collar workers were, would the elites be so blasé about immigration? Which is really fascinating, and in a way, it flips on its head things that opponents of free trade agreements on the left, including myself, have been making for years, which is that if professionals were as threatened by offshoring as let's say manufacturing workers were, the opposition to these trade agreements would rise. Now, of course, since the days that NAFTA was enacted in 1994, more and more professionals are threatened by offshoring as more jobs can be done digitally abroad, and in fact opposition to the trade agreements has risen since 1994 as the middle class has hollowed out. So Cruz is doing sort of the demagogic flip side of this, but it's an interesting ad because it's directed at Trump supporters who tend to be people without college education, all white, of course, but I mean, when you say all white, you're talking about the base of any Republican candidate these days, and largely secular, more concerned about economic concerns. That's who Trump's base is. Cruz's base is more the evangelical wing of the Republican Party, and in general, over the last several decades, when the Republican primary elections roll around on the presidential level, they have tended to pit the candidate with evangelical support against a more establishment candidate. What Trump has done is really introduced sort of a third wing of the Republican Party, the non-evangelical working class Republicans, and to a certain degree, his agenda reflects that. I mean, he's made a point of saying he's not going to cut Social Security and Medicare, which matters a lot to these folks. But he is been brilliant at laying the blame for their woes on immigrants, stoking those phobias as Republicans tend to do. But Trump has obviously taken it to a new level. So anyway, we have those two ads appeared this week, and so I wrote a column on the Prospect website showing the footage of those ads, but also showing the footage that ran during the 1994 re-election campaign of Republican California Governor Pete Wilson, who was trailing in the polls, but then decided to do the first really modern major immigrant-bashing Republican campaign since California was rapidly getting lots of immigrants from south of the border at that point.
So this is Pete Wilson who was running for governor of California in 1994.
Yeah, he was actually trailing at the time. His opponent was actually Jerry Brown's sister, who had been the state treasurer, Kathleen Brown. She was leading, but then there was a ballot measure which would have denied all public services to undocumented immigrants, including, you know, for kids, the right to attend public schools, you know, K-12 schools. We're not talking university here. And Wilson decided to pour money into that as well as his own campaign to whip up a white backlash. He was reelected. The measure passed. It was almost immediately struck down in the courts. And given the demographic composition of California, he managed to doom the Republican Party there for ever since. I did a calculation for the column and figured out that there have been 57 times since 1994 candidates for statewide office have stood for election. There are eight constitutional officers, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, et cetera, and the two U.S. senators. And of those 57 elections, the Republicans have won exactly one regularly scheduled election, which is Arnold Schwarzenegger's election as governor in 2002, and have lost the other 56 to the Democrats, which shows that as a long-term strategy, Wilson's white nationalist nativist campaign was not a winner, and I don't think in a long-term sense the anti-immigrant nativist and in many ways racist policies, certainly of Trump and Cruz, but in many ways of the Republican Party in general, are going to be anything but sort of a long-term electoral suicide for the Republicans as well. But then what I did is I really trace this back to, in many ways, the first political ad that ever screened anywhere. Which goes back to 1934. In that year, this is kind of an interesting prefiguring of Bernie
Sanders.
Well,
before we get into that, is this kind of a good news, bad news thing that if we get the bad news that Donald Trump or Ted Cruz actually, heaven forbid, becomes president of the United States, that you think that would be kind of a Pyrrhic victory and very short-lived because it would so antagonize the minority votes that, you know, nationally it would destroy the Republican Party among minorities, just like Pete Wilson did hurt the Republicans long-term in the California politics?
Pretty much, but I think it would also be a huge obstacle to either of them winning the general election this year. I mean, we already have, you know, I mean, if Trump is the nominee, I think you can anticipate a surge in Latino and Asian turnout, and you can assume that they'll be voting for the Democrat at perhaps something like a 90% rate. I mean, people forget how in recent years the very diverse internally Asian American community, which is growing fast, indeed, California had more immigrants from Asia last year than it did from Latin America. That the Asian community has taken a decisively Democratic turn in recent years, probably in part responding to all of the Republican nativist demagogy. And so I think this would be a real impediment to a Republican winning this year, even with the theory that they can get white voters, you know, who are hiding under rocks and bring them to the polls to vote for them. So, I mean, but long term, it's certainly, I think, an electoral disaster. And a lot of Republicans realize this. They did the Republican National Committee commissioned a study after the 2012 election, and, you know, noticed that Romney had gotten a historically very large percentage of the white vote and still lost. And if he'd gotten that percentage 10 years earlier, he would have won, except the nation
grew.
The racial demographics of the nation have changed and will continue to change.
Mm-hmm.
This is why voter suppression is so crucial to Republican prospects. I mean, really, if minority voters turn out at a decent rate, they are doomed. And so voter suppression is not simply the icing on the Republican cake. It's the cake.
Yeah, and I was surprised to learn in your column on the Prospect website today that just how far back the strategy of voter repression goes for the Republicans. It, to me, it just seems so anti-democratic, but they've been doing this really since the beginning of the 20th century, haven't they?
Well, yeah. I mean, voter suppression is you know, a technique used by, you know, elites who are scared of the people beneath them. And so obviously the whole Jim Crow order in the South was intended by the Southern Democrats to keep African Americans from voting. But, you know, Republicans in northern cities, but you know, beginning in the late 19th century, were none too crazy about all the new immigrants voting, and you know, essentially, many times the big city Democratic machines of old, like Tammany, would register people as they, you know, came in off Ellis Island. This is a time-honored strategy, but what really struck me, because it you know, was the origin of the attack ad on the voters swarming over the borders, which is a Republican time-honored tradition, it actually goes back to the first screened political ads, even though they weren't ads. And this, as I said, was in response to the 1934 gubernatorial campaign of the well-known socialist author Upton Sinclair. One second. Upton Sinclair, who re-registered Democrat and, to everyone's astonishment, won the 1934 Democratic gubernatorial primary in California. Again, there might be some lessons here for Bernie Sanders folks. Mm-hmm. The Republicans completely freaked out, and actually the establishment Democrats didn't know what the hell to do about it either. And so they devised a lot of strategies which might seem quite familiar today. They embarked on a voter suppression campaign, getting some judge to rule that if you didn't really have a home address or if you moved recently and you showed up to vote, you could be sentenced for voter fraud and sent to prison for 7 years. The state Supreme Court actually nullified that order shortly before the election, but it obviously had some effect.
Trying to stop Upton Sinclair from becoming governor of Wisconsin.
Yes, and he was favored. He was favored to become governor of California, yes.
Mm.
The more dramatic development was that all of the Hollywood studios, the studio execs, were scared to death of Sinclair winning because of his high tax proposals and such as that, and decided to film what were ostensibly some newsreels that would really undercut Sinclair, even though they weren't newsreels. And this was undertaken by the biggest of the studios, MGM, whose president, Louis B. Mayer, was actually also the state Republican Party chairman at the time. But it was cooked up by the studio chief there, Irving Thalberg, who was sort of acknowledged as a production chief genius at the time. Thalberg sent out a crew with actors and extras and others to play the part of people streaming across the border who were unsavory, speaking in foreign accents, looking disreputable, and they were to be contrasted with upright, straight-looking folk who said they were for the Republican incumbent governor, Frank Merriam. And these were screened in the last 3 weeks of the campaign as newsreels, not as commercials, in every movie theater in the state, which led to some fights inside theaters when the Sinclair supporters, of whom there were many, you know, were innocently sitting there waiting for the feature film to start and saw this stuff on the screen. But you know, this is the origins of the dangerous horde streaming across the border, even though it was completely fictitious and marketed as fact. And something that's important to consider here, because it's an interesting object lesson. Just starting then, and more in the years following, California experienced a lot of internal migration from other states, most notably, which we know through the book and the film of The Grapes of Wrath, the Okies fleeing the Dust Bowl. And, you know, for those who think that this needs to be entirely, a racially or culturally based feeling that is whipped up, we need to remember that there were right-wing vigilante groups on the border of California, between California and Arizona and California and Nevada, that turned these folks away, and that there were frequent attacks on migrant worker camps in California by these same folks on the Okies. So you could be, a native-born, God-fearing, Protestant, American, Oklahoma resident, and still, if you're, sufficient anxiety and rabble-rousing behind it, you could be deemed, the other, just mm-hmm. like immigrants from Mexico and Lord knows where else. So there's kind of a long tradition of this, and I was just able to put up in conjunction with this my article, some of the footage from these newsreels, the Pete Wilson ad from 1994, and the Trump and Cruz ads. And of course, you can go to scenes of this in the great 1940 movie The Grapes of Wrath, which is a fictionalized version of but rooted in fact. So it's a long tradition. It's a long, sordid American Republican tradition.
Good. That's an excellent analysis of what's happening there on the Republican side. I encourage our listeners to go to the website. It's prospect.org for Harold yeah. Meyerson's article there and really see the whole thing. It's very illuminating to see how deep this kind of an approach goes and how long Republican candidates have used this to get themselves into power and divide people for their own personal self-interest. Let's talk about the Democratic side for a minute, a little shinier. We've got our hero here, Senator Bernie Sanders, who continues to amaze and to have very large turnouts on the Democratic side, hearing him speak, including an awesome speech he gave this week. Do you think Bernie Sanders really has a chance to get the Democratic nomination for president?
I wouldn't bet a large sum on it. If I was could bet a small sum and given really good odds, I might put something down.
Not betting the mortgage on this one.
Absolutely not. Maybe the mortgage on my pencil sharpener, but not on the house. I just don't think there's enough support there to get to 50% plus one. But let's keep in mind that Bernie has outperformed every anything that he or anyone else could have anticipated, and that his campaign is serving a hugely important function whether he wins or not. He's certainly helped drive the political discourse, which I think in many ways is already moving towards the left, more in the direction of economic and social justice and equity. So that's a huge contribution, whether or not he can win the nomination.
I agree with that, and I don't know if you happen to catch his speech about his New Year's resolution this week, where he essentially said his New Year's resolution is that if big business doesn't stop their greed, we will stop it for them. And the crowd just went absolutely wild. He's giving voice to that anger that so many people have about the deck being stacked in favor of big business and the very wealthy, and he's really tapped into that into a powerful way.
He has, and there's all kinds of polling data that indicate that whether or not Bernie was in the race and saying these things, that's a really kind of widespread belief across the body politic that the super rich are gaining at the expense of at the expense of the middle class and everybody else, and that there need to be some serious changes to our economy to bring back that middle class.
Absolutely. And I know I've talked to some very active Democrats, and they say they really – like Bernie Sanders more, and they support his kind of economic populist kind of program addressing all the economic concerns, but they are supporting Hillary Clinton because they think she'll have the best chance to win the general election, and they are absolutely terrified about the Republicans getting a hold of the White House in addition to their majority control in the U.S. House and Senate. What would you say to those people?
Well, they have a point. And even though at times Bernie in current polls may run better against Donald Trump than Hillary would, no one on the right has really targeted an anti-Bernie campaign yet. And I think what happened to Upton Sinclair might be illustrative here. Sinclair was a Democratic socialist like Bernie and very well known, but the Republicans, you know, created utterly fictitious stuff about him, linked him with communism, which he was distinctly not. In fact, the Communist Party in 1934 was vehemently anti-Upton because he wasn't them, basically. And, you know, there's certainly a case to be made that that would happen were Bernie the nominee. On the other hand, there's no doubt that he probably has the most energized, dedicated supporters of any of the candidates on either party running for president this year, and that's worth a lot. So all that said, I think the people who say what you just relayed do have a point. And, you know, the flip side of that, though, is the Hillary people have been very wary about attacking Bernie, precisely because they know they need that that support and that energy should she win the nomination to win the general election.
Right. Yeah, I've actually been very pleased to see that both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton just not attacking each other. They're addressing the issues vigorously, but they are not attacking each other, and that's a real delight. I'm glad to keep the focus where it needs to be.
Right, and in contradistinction to the candidates in the other party.
Yes, and you're very right. I think both Bernie and Hillary are doing very well in terms of getting good organization on the ground. It was one sign of hope I saw when the New York Times did a story a couple of weeks ago analyzing Donald Trump's campaign in Iowa and saying he's getting thousands of people to turn out to his rallies, but that's not translating to on-the-ground organizing. And as someone who's worked in many campaigns, I know how critical it is to get your people out on the day of voting, and that he had actually very few leaders of the caucuses, particularly in Iowa, so that the big turnout for a rally does not automatically turn into votes on election day, particularly in Iowa with the caucus structure where people have to spend many hours there. They can't just go and drop in a vote. They have to go.
Right. Well, there's an interesting sociological point here, which is to say Trump needs to have an organization, and given who his followers tend to be, he needs to have a working-class organization. Now, the only real working-class organizations around are unions, who sure the hell aren't backing Donald Trump. And he faces some particular challenges that he and his campaign and most campaign consultants really don't, certainly no Republican campaign consultants, really don't know quite how to do. Working class organization is not their forte. They're probably existentially clueless about this, and so I would imagine that that's a real challenge.
Yes. And, you know, speaking of organization, you mentioned the last time on the show that you thought Obama made a strategic mistake in letting the movement dissipate after he was elected president. Do you think the left will be able to build on the incredible energy of the Sanders campaign, win or lose?
I think it has to. That doesn't mean it will, but it has to. No, I mean, the Sanders campaign is notable for any number of reasons, including it really has, as it were, gathered more progressives and progressive energy under one roof than anything in a very long time. And you don't want to squander that energy, the day after the campaign ends. It would be a huge resource in moving the United States in a more progressive and humane direction if some kind of network or organization could emerge from the Sanders campaign when, no matter how it ends, when it ends. And I'm encouraged that he has been endorsed by the Working Families Party, which is now in 11 states, which really functions, that the name is a bit of a misnomer, really functions as sort of a left-wing group largely within, though not exclusively within, the Democratic Party, and is really sort of set up the most concrete on-the-ground left-wing presence wherever it has gone. So that could be one basis for putting together a network. We on the left have the capacity to, in some ways, alter the discussion. Occupy Wall Street certainly did that, and it was a very positive contribution. But it didn't have any institutional afterlife, whereas, you know, the Republicans on the right, the Tea Party, et cetera, set up all these organizations which go into elections and win elections and have moved the Republican Party in a rightward direction. And the American left certainly needs a counterpart. And I think the Sanders campaign provides that opportunity. And I want to make one thing clear, by the way. It shouldn't be limited just to people who support Bernie Sanders. There was a CBS New York Times poll in late November or early December that found that 56% of people who described themselves as likely Democratic primary voters had a favorable impression of socialism. Now, putting aside the inherent difficulties of actually defining socialism in the year 2016, mm-hmm. and the fact that Sanders, in his speech at Georgetown University, defined it more or less as sort of a continuation of the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt, which would have been a surprise to socialists of the 1930s and 40s, I think. Putting all of that aside, what was notable to me was that this 56% who had this favorable impression of socialism on the same poll, they asked you if you were for Hillary or Bernie, and about 30% said they were for Bernie. Well, that means 25% of this survey, of the people who weren't for Bernie still said they had a favorable impression of socialism. Now, that leads one to think that, the progressive institution coming out of the Sanders campaign could extend well beyond institutions and people involved in the Sanders campaign itself. And Lord knows there are a lot of unions who actually agree with everything Bernie Sanders says, but for one reason or another have endorsed Hillary Clinton, and should be interested in building such a such an institution as well.
Right, and then that gets back to the Democrats I was talking about, that they agree with a lot of what Bernie says, but they're actually supporting Hillary for president. So you're right to say if we want to build kind of an institutional grounding and a stronger way for progressive politics, it would be kind of the Bernie Sanders campaign plus some of the Hillary supporters, plus I think some of the Republicans could be interested in a progressive politics, plus maybe some people who are just have been so turned off that they haven't been engaged, but if there was a serious progressive movement, they might get excited about that.
Let us hope.
On that point, you know, we often hear about people who have kind of given up on politics, so they don't bother to vote. Only about half the eligible people made it to the polls in the last election. Given what's at stake in this year's elections, what would you say to people who say voting doesn't really matter, my vote doesn't count?
Well, this is connected to lots of things. I think both Trump and Bernie, in their own ways, are providing solutions, both bad and good, respectively, to this conundrum by saying things which resonate not only with people who traditionally vote, but with people who don't traditionally vote, being a voice really for people who think normally that the political system has little to offer them. And I think, you know, that's there are lessons there. I mean, and you know, both of them also have narratives with clear villains. You know, Trump's villains are immigrants who are generally all but desperate. Bernie's villains are the Wall Street types who have completely misshapen the American economy at the expense of the majority of the American people. So, you know, empirically, I'd say Bernie's analysis has a lot more going for it than Trump's, to put it mildly. But I think that's important. I think it's important to point out that the establishment narrative of the decline of the middle class, which is, well, it's, you know, it's globalization, it's technology, it's forces beyond our control that are happen just as automatically as the rising of the sun in the east, you know, is a, among other things, a hugely depoliticizing message. And, you know, not accidentally is it a politically de-energizing message. And I think the notion that human agency is in many ways responsible for how screwed up we have become and that human agency can be called upon to fix things is a more empowering and hopeful message. And that's what Bernie is offering, and in its own warped, bigoted way, it's what Donald Trump is offering.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we were talking a little bit there about President Obama. He's got 1 year left as president. He seems energized and wanting to do as much as he can with the remaining time. And this week he issued an executive order about guns, saying, well, Congress is unwilling and unable to act on trying to keep people safe from gun violence, so he issued an executive order. Can you tell us what did that gun measure do, and what else do you expect Obama to do with his 1 year left as president?
Well, I think Obama will do everything he can that can be done by executive order, which I think is the right response. I mean, there's no way anything really progressive or even slightly progressive is going to emerge from Congress except as a part of a must-pass budget deal. So he will do whatever he can on, I think, labor issues. He's already acted, you know, considerably on making federal contractors behave better, on wages of the overtime regulations for workers when you're eligible. He's greatly changed that in the Department of Labor rules so that workers who make more than $23,000 a year can still be eligible for overtime, even if they're in a managerial position. On gun control, he has ordered the Departments of Defense, Justice, and Homeland Security to see about safer gun technology. But there are real limits to everything he does because really, you know, serious change does require laws that Congress should pass. The Center for Disease Control is forbidden by law from studying the effects of gun violence, and that will require Congress to reverse that decision. So there are all kinds of things he can sort of do. By the way, one thing his commissioners at the Security and Exchange Commission could do, the SEC, where three of the five appointees are his, so that's a majority, is repeal a rule that was enacted during Ronald Reagan's presidency that really has allowed for the flood of stock buybacks, which has diverted corporate profits away from expansion, research, investment, and wages into essentially rewarding shareholders, particularly rewarding big shareholders. I mean, that's one of these administrative rules that the administration could undertake by itself, and I would hope that would be one of the things that President Obama's appointees at the SEC do in 2016.
Yeah, that would be promising. And speaking of Congress and how intransigent they've been, and we know now transcripts coming out are descriptions of meetings where the Republicans said their strategy is to deny President Obama any victories while president. So they've been kind of the party of no for the past 7 years. What are the prospects for Democrats regaining a majority, at least in the U.S. Senate?
In the Senate, it's entirely possible. There are a number of Republicans in the Senate who were elected in the Republican low turnout GOP landslide Tea Party year of 2010. Toomey in Pennsylvania, Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, and several more, Mark Kirk in Illinois, who probably may well lose now that we're in a high turnout presidential year as they seek re-election to their first term. I think there's a reasonable chance the Democrats could retake the Senate. The House is another story. The districts that the Congress members represent were carved by disproportionately by Republican legislators after the 2010 census and the 2010 election, and it's a it's a pretty gerrymandered body, and I think it'd be very hard for the Democrats to retake the House. So if the Republicans nominate Trump, there is a chance that is more than theoretical, but still a bit of a long shot in terms of the Democrats retaking the House.
Yeah, we're stymied by the districting. I mean, we know that a million more people voted for Democrats than Republicans for House seats last time, but that still wasn't enough to get the House into Democratic hands because the districting favored the Republicans.
And there are states where there was a clear tilt towards Democratic voting on House candidates, but which is still, because of the way the districts are carved, overwhelmingly Republican majorities in the House delegations. Pennsylvania comes to mind as a particular example of that. Definitely a Democratic state in many ways, but with a Republican congressional delegation due to really a kind of a heroic job almost of gerrymandering by the Republicans.
Yes. So, you know, looking with a little bit of a broader lens now, we've had some disturbing events recently. We've had the terrorist attacks in Paris and San Bernardino. We have the Mideast turmoil. The war in Syria goes on. Tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia flaring up this week. Now we got North Korea a couple of days ago claiming it tested successfully a hydrogen bomb. Do you think the Republicans are going to benefit from an unsettled international scene, and who do you think is the best of the candidates to lead us in the fight against terrorism?
Well, I mean, clearly Hillary Clinton has more experience dealing with these issues than any candidate in either party by a long shot. That said, some of this stuff is easy for the Republicans to demagogue on, although, you know, for all of the criticism of Obama's policy in the Middle East and, you know, Republican, Ted Cruz talking about carpet bombing ISIS, Republicans really haven't come up with that much of an alternative strategy in the Middle East, least of all for, you know, to a certain degree, the question of, there's a Sunni-Shiite split emerging. It's been there for some time, obviously, which is exacerbated by the tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Where do we come down here? An interesting conundrum, sort of like the 30 Years' War in 17th century Europe between Protestants and Catholics. A little asking, you know, what side are the Jews on? hard to say. I would add one other international event which may really end up being a problem for the Democrats. And that is the looming economic mess in China, which now for two successive days has suspended stock trading after about 30 minutes. Because the stock values in China have just plummeted. So much of what the world sells and so much of what we sell goes to China that this could have an effect on the U.S. economy. We don't know how big. We don't know what the extent is. But if, you know, if our always tepid recovery should actually go into reverse, or shudder to a halt, that likely will probably help the Republicans as well. So that's another thing to make you nervous, in addition to little things like North Korea claiming it has a hydrogen bomb, which you know, should keep just about anyone up at night at least a little.
Right, exactly. And we should say that the Obama administration has said their evidence shows that it was not a successful test. So we don't know how they know that, but they are saying the reports are exaggerated. But just the fact that they're thinking about it and working on it there in North Korea is a very scary thought.
Right, and the administration hasn't said that the Chinese stock market hasn't tanked.
No,
that's confirmable, you know. So all kinds of East Asian worries of different kinds, but all of which could have some electoral consequence.
Absolutely, and it is concerning to see not once but twice already this week China had to shut down its stock market because the value dropped for 7%. What do you think is needed to prevent another economic crisis like 2007 and 2008?
Well, remember, 2007 and 2008 was an economic crisis that affected the world but began here. We're now looking at, this is the problem, an economic crisis that begins somewhere else but could affect here.
Right.
For which is ample precedent. I mean, you know, the stock market crash of 29 began here and certainly set the world on a pretty disastrous economic course, but the plunge was greatly accelerated by the failure of a major Austrian bank in 1931, which caused a European collapse, which really furthered the collapse in this country. So when you ask what can we do about a crisis, an economic crisis that begins somewhere else in the private sector, the unfortunate answer is not a hell of a lot. You know, I mean, it would be great if the American public had enough purchasing power to enable American companies to withstand the effects of this, but of course that would have required a far greater preservation of middle-class jobs and wages than we've seen over the last 40 years. So if we could go back and reset that, we'd be in better shape, but we can't.
Well, and then there's some discussion about we could perhaps pass a kind of a new version of the Glass-Steagall Act to regulate the financial industry more. Do you think that would help?
Well, you sure. I mean, when you talk about what we can do domestically, there's a hell of a lot. I mean, both Clinton and Sanders have a financial oversight proposals, both of which are good, and each claims that his or hers is better. I would just like to see the proposals of both of them enacted. They each address crying needs in different parts of the financial sector. So that would certainly help. Both of them support major infrastructure development, which would certainly generate jobs. That would help. Legislation that would make it less death-defying to join a union, which would then help boost wages, would certainly help. I mean, there are all kinds of things we can do domestically to bolster the economy. My only point here was that there are some events abroad that could make this a rocky year over which we really don't have all that much control. It would also have helped if the Federal Reserve had not raised interest rates a couple of weeks ago, but and I would actually be surprised to see much more of that given the danger signs we're seeing from the global economy. But even that, I think, was a mistake.
Yeah, and now we're seeing in today's paper, they say how close that decision was at the Federal Reserve that it about raising the rates, that it was really a serious debate, and they came close to not doing it, but not raising
right.
the rates. But so I think that makes it unlikely they're going to raise the interest rates much more in the near term anyway.
Right.
You know, there was a surprise announcement, at least surprise to me this week, that there's a new presidential candidate announced, and it's Gary Johnson running as a Libertarian. Do you think if he wins the Libertarian nomination, he'd be included in the national debates for the general election, and do you think he'll be anything of a factor there in the general?
No and no. I think... they've never included a third-party candidate in a presidential debate, the commission that decides this, and I don't think there's any chance of that happening unless he has Ross Perot levels of support, which he won't. Interestingly, I think the one chance of getting a major third-party candidate or third candidate, whether or not there's a party, would be in the very unlikely event that Bernie Sanders gets the Democratic nomination, in which case I would bet that we would see Michael Bloomberg enter running a self-funded campaign, and he has got a lot more money than Donald Trump as sort of the you know, centrist, as it were, candidate between Bernie and the Republican nominee. But I don't think that's going to happen because I don't think Bernie is going to get the nomination, but I don't really think a Libertarian candidate is going to have much traction. I mean, you know, look, there was a Libertarian candidate in the Republican field, Rand Paul,
mm-hmm.
and he has not exactly right. set the world on fire, or the Republican Party, or American conservatives on fire.
Right? Yeah, he went nowhere, and he had the ability to draw on some of the organization and people that supported his father, Ron Paul, another Libertarian.
Right. Right, and he could raise a lot more money than Gary Johnson could, and he's still in the, you know, 2% category. So I don't really see much much traction going to Gary Johnson.
Yeah. You know, looking kind of big picture here, it's very clear the political system represents the interests of big business and lobbyists, often over the interests of the people, and that's caused much frustration among Americans, Democrat, Republican, and everybody, really. How do we change that? Do we need to overturn Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision, to make any real headway, or what else can we do to address that control of our government?
Well, we do, but there are also things that localities have done and that states are looking at that I think would also help. And one is to create public matching funds in elections for candidates who've demonstrated a sufficient base of support. In New York City, a candidate who gets enough signatures and enough, not all that many, enough small dollar contributions is then entitled to a 6-to-1 match of campaign contributions from public funds. And this is one reason why there is a real progressive majority on the New York City Council today. There are a lot of candidates who could not have won under conventional campaign finance laws who are now sitting on the council and passing all kinds of progressive ordinances. And I think this is a model we are going to see, particularly in other cities, which tend to be, at this period, the most distinctly progressive jurisdictions in the country. So there's that, and I would urge people to support that. Certainly not even the Supreme Court has struck this down yet. They have struck down the ability of a candidate getting public matching funds to get more funds if a candidate not taking funds exceeds a certain dollar threshold, but they have not struck down the ability of candidates to just receive this kind of match in general. And I think that's an important democratizing step in the political process.
Yes, that would be great. And I've been hearing some now about this Trans-Pacific Partnership is rearing its ugly head. Where does that stand? Do we have any hope of keeping that out and stopping it?
Well, I think it's unpopular politically in both parties, at least in the base of both parties. Donald Trump has come out against it. Hillary Clinton, however authentically or not, has come out against it. Bernie Sanders has been against it from the get-go. So I think, out of deference to the Democratic presidential candidates, the Obama administration understands it doesn't want to bring this up before the election. That would surprise me if they did. Mitch McConnell, also fearing repercussions if Republicans support it, also has said that he won't let it come to a vote in the Senate before the election. So I think it's on hold for a while. By the way, there was a fascinating little story yesterday that under the terms of NAFTA, Canada has now sued the United States for not going ahead and building the Keystone XL pipeline.
Oh, no.
And if that isn't an argument which will be used against TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I don't know what is. I mean, it's just so clearly shows the perils of these kinds of trade pacts. I would imagine if and when TPP does finally come before Congress sometimes after early November of this year, those of us who oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership are going to be saying, hey, look at this. This is what happens when you pass this kind of trade deal. So this is the first trade deal, I think, that really faces obstacles high enough that it may not pass. So we shall see.
Yeah, that's encouraging, and for our listeners to know, that's one of the reasons to be against TPP. It's sometimes described as NAFTA on steroids, kind of setting the rules for big business and not really protecting workers, consumers, or the environment, or even national sovereignty, for that matter, as you're pointing out with the potential suit there. So that's all the time we have. I would like to thank you once again, Harold, for being with us today.
My pleasure, and I apologize for coughing at your listeners.